conventional energy sources are either finite or unsustainable. Is there an alternative to alternative energy? In fact, energy is either renewable or sustainable, or it is not, period. So if you take away anything from the talk tonight, it might be that there is no longer any such thing as alternative energy. Renewable energy, sustainable energy are now the politically correct terms, at least in the blue states. Okay. I have two objectives in my talk tonight. One is obvious, the other is devious. The obvious one is to dispel some myths about the environmental impacts of renewable energy. The second, the devious one, is to get all of you to think about the notion of personal responsibility with regard to your energy use. In other words, and these are not my own, these are the words of a man, Joe Jenkins, who is a slate roofing contractor in Pennsylvania. He would ask, where is your personal balance point between accepting the gifts that nature has to offer and returning the favor? Something I'll come back to at the end. In the abstract of the talk, I said that no technology or human activity, regardless of its apparent benefit, is without environmental consequence. In other words, whenever we extract energy from our environment, it has some detrimental effect, whether we recognize it or not. And here I want to emphasize a term that I use often, our environment. That personal pronoun, our, implies ownership, or better yet, stewardship, instead of something impersonal and separated from us, the environment. From a physical point of view, the Earth and our star are a closed system. We live on a rocky, metal-rich planet, roughly 93 million miles away from a perfectly ordinary main sequence star. This star has been and continues to be our one and only source of energy, even though the sunlit side of the planet receives one part in 2 billion of the sun's radiated energy. For those who think in terms of percentages, that's 0.0000005% of the sun's energy reaches our planet. Without that one part in 2 billion, all life would very quickly perish. So, from an energetic point of view, the Earth exists in something a scientist might call a metastable equilibrium. That is, its energy inputs must match its energy outputs, the re-radiation of this energy into space, or unstable things begin to happen. Like what? Like global warming, the global climate crisis. And its direct consequences, which are rapid and frequent changes in the weather patterns, glacial melting, rising sea levels, habitat destruction, and loss of species on a massive scale. These are all things we are seeing right now. These sorts of things are obvious to most scientists. But interestingly, the global climate crisis is not simply a consequence of our excessive energy use. It has been caused unintentionally or ignorantly, depending on your point of view, by the byproducts of that energy generation. And I'm thinking here of the gases, carbon dioxide, methane, chlorofluorocarbons. Most people here will be familiar with all of those. I think it's, as you know, CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, are especially potent and long-lived greenhouse gases. I think it's ironic that something called global warming should have its origin in a synthetic gas whose primary use is refrigeration. All right. This directly leads into the main part of the talk, and that's a distinction between the quantifiable effects, environmental impacts of energy generation, and the not so or less than quantifiable effects of energy generation. I'm going to start with the quantifiable ones, the ones that are easy to measure, and those are the emissions into the atmosphere by conventional generation from coal, oil, nuclear, natural gas, or from renewables. One of the references there comes from REP, the Renewable Energy Policy Project. This is an outstanding report available on the web. It was published in year 2000. It's entitled The Environmental Imperative for Renewable Energy, an update of a report they did years before that. It's very, very clear and uncompromising in the conclusions it reaches. Only the last sentence is pertinent. The future must be renewable. We don't have any other choice. I'm going to show you some graphs from it. Air emissions, called criteria pollutants. Now, it's a definition in the Clean Air Act of 1970, actually. Sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, particulate matter, suspended particles in the air, ozone, not on that chart, carbon monoxide, and lead was the other criteria pollutant. The interesting number here is that last row in the table. Utility contribution, electric utility contribution to the total atmospheric emissions from our country. 26% of all the nitrogen oxides in our atmosphere come from electric generating utilities. 64% of all the sulfur dioxide comes from electric generation. Two-thirds of it. Trivial amounts of particulate matter and carbon dioxide and others. Mercury, not a criteria pollutant, for what reasons are unclear to me. It's a volatile metal. One-third of all the mercury in our atmosphere settles out, gets into plant material, gets into the food chain, is created by electric utilities. Those are meaningful numbers. They're big numbers, big contributions. Anyone who uses electricity is responsible for that bottom row. Land, water, and solid waste impacts of various energy generating technologies. The important sort of quick overview is to note the zeros, or the low numbers associated with PV, wind, geothermal, meaning actual underground heat. That's a relatively minor contribution to the energy in this country, but it's quantitated here nonetheless. Biopower, meaning the combustion of biological materials. And then next to that, coal and nuclear. All you have to do is just look at the magnitude of the numbers and compare the renewables to conventional technologies, coal and nuclear. And this is coal with desulfurization. Nuclear looks pretty good until you see this little thing in the right-hand corner, low lev WA. That's not such a little thing in the bottom right-hand corner. It's the most serious problem that exists in the world today. Is what are we going to do with that nuclear waste? It's not going away. It never will. It's accidents waiting to happen. As a physicist, I cannot wrap my brain around dealing with this material for millennia. Human beings are good, but they're not that good. There is no safe way to deal with this material. It should be ruled out for all time. There's another report. It's quite long, by the International Energy Agency, addressing just what the topic is tonight. Are renewables benign energy? Nothing is benign. They reached the same conclusion in this report, and this comes back to a question Rob had earlier about CO2. Renewables on the top table and conventional electric generation in the UK. Here it is broken down into quantifiable gases, CO2, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen oxides. Again, the numbers are unimportant except for the magnitudes. Uniformly, these are one or two orders of magnitude less than these numbers. Tens of times to hundreds of times less quantifiable emissions resulting from using renewables for energy generation compared to conventional energy sources. All right? And this is taking into account the whole life cycle, by the way. What do I mean by life cycle? It's a long list. Resource extraction, okay, digging up the coal. Resource transportation, moving it to wherever you're going to burn it. Processing it, grinding it up. Component manufacture, that would refer to if you're generating a product like a PV module, okay, but it applies to a conventional technology. The transportation of that product, the construction of the plant to burn the coal or to make the PV module, the operation of the energy plant, the decommissioning of the plant once it's reached its old age, and then the disposal of all the materials that are in the plant, reclaiming them. That's the life cycle that we're talking about here. That's what these studies try to do, is figure out what the total life cycle emissions from these technologies versus the old technologies are. Conclusion is 1 to 2 orders of magnitude less for renewables in terms of quantifiable emissions. Back to the beginning, where I was more philosophical. All the energy on this planet came from the sun. Ancient sunlight is responsible for that coal. We're releasing it now. It was formed over millions of years. We're releasing all of that energy in a period of the last 200 years, the industrial age. Millions of years to create it, all released in 200 years. That's an abrupt insult to the environment. We just don't have enough of a buffer in our biosphere to absorb that without there being some impact. It's the time scale you consider. And the only time scale that has any relevance for human beings is the future, the next 100 years, maybe. The entire fate of the human species will be decided in the next century, I have no doubt. Okay, let's quickly go through some of the less than quantifiable, the non-obvious, perhaps, environmental impacts of these renewable energy technologies. Wind. Okay. Wind is a hotly debated topic, not only in New York, but nationwide. The controversial issues of wind turbine construction include their impact on land use, birds and bat populations, noise, and concerns about the view shed, a new term in my vocabulary in the last year. Of those, I think I can quickly dismiss all of them with one exception, and that's land use. Wherever roads must be constructed to give access to anything, including wind turbines, the environmental impact becomes considerable. Creating roads where none existed before creates the potential for additional impacts that may not have been anticipated. I'm thinking here of roads through the rainforest. I'm thinking here of the current administration's disregard for a policy that was called the roadless rule. So large wind farms, even though they might seem benign, clearly have an impact. Their development seems to be somewhat at odds with this concept we call distributed generation. Lots of little point of use electric generating facilities, like solar on a rooftop, or a smaller wind turbine at a factory, point of use, energy generation and usage. A large wind farm any way you look at it, is a centralized energy generating facility. And as such, it has a larger impact. Something to consider. There's a table. These tables are very boring, but they go through the whole life cycle here, from the top, extracting the resource, down to the bottom, decommissioning of the device or the resource at the end. Who does it impact? What is the impact? What is the range of the impact? Is it local? Is it regional? Is it global? What's the priority of it? How much concern should we have about it? Uniformly low throughout for wind, except here. During its generation, are they noisy? Do they have a visual impact? Those seem to be the issues for people. Noise and visual impact, not very quantifiable. I included two pages in the handout. One about first pages from a couple of articles in Home Power magazine. Home Power is where I received a lot of my education about renewable energy. It's not exactly a scholarly publication, but it's extremely practical. And there's remarkably good information in it. Mick Sagrillo, the author of this particular article, is probably one of the world's experts on the installation and operation of small wind turbines. He has a company in Michigan who has put up hundreds of small wind turbines. So he felt the need to address it, and so he did in this article, that there's no doubt that in one case in particular, and that's Altamont Pass in California, there were bird deaths. Not only were they bird deaths, they were raptors. And that really got people concerned. Mick had some comments about that. It's a paragraph that begins with perspective. Scientists consider the low number of bird deaths in wind farms biologically insignificant, especially when compared to other human causes of bird deaths, bird mortality. Now, in the Altamont Pass, we're talking about the mortality of a few dozens to a few hundreds of birds. Automobiles are responsible for some 57 million bird deaths every year. It's unlikely that anyone in this room who owns an automobile hasn't hit a bird at some point or another in their driving careers. Unfortunately, I know I have. And it's a painful sort of a bad feeling in your stomach when it happens. But there it is. 57 million versus a few hundred documented at Altamont Pass. And Altamont Pass is the worst situation. 97 million birds die by flying into plate glass windows every year. Most people who feed birds know that they also run right into your plate glass windows from time to time. Yep.
For plate glass, how
many? 97 million.
They don't have that broken down for the raptors.
No, although he does have quite a bit to say about raptors. Anyway, what another factor that Mick doesn't talk about, which has been discussed, anybody who owns a cat also has a serious bird issue to deal with. Perspective, again. Humans, by virtue of being the owners of cats and automobiles and plate glass windows, those dwarf any possible effect of wind turbines on bird mortality.
Also, cell phone towers and tall buildings are big bird killers as well.
There was an article, I think it was in National Geographic, where they had a spread of all the birds that had been killed by a high-rise building, and I think it was in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And it included raptors, it included like migratory small songbirds, and it was really striking. I mean, just in one city, how many birds were killed. I think it's National Geographic, like 2 years ago.
I'm going to move on to PV. That's what I know most about. Again, here's one of those boring tables with impacts on it. component manufacturer, high. It's the aluminum frames. If you incorporate them into buildings without aluminum frames, that becomes low. But aluminum is an energy-intensive metal. Ecology, land use, low to high. What does that mean? Well, if you start covering the state of Arizona with solar panels, maybe it would have a high impact. We haven't seen that yet. If you're putting on a roof, there's no impact whatsoever on land use. Visual impact, low to high. It's a subjective sort of thing. Okay, back to that thing I talked about right at the beginning. The environmental impact of solar in terms of their energy, the energy inherent in their manufacture compared with what they end up generating. Critics of solar energy claim that it takes more energy to produce modules than the modules would produce in their lifetime. We've done a detailed study. The conclusion, PVs recoup their production energy in 2 to 4 years and go on to produce clean renewable energy for 20 to 30 years. Of course, the energy generation rate depends on where you put it. Are you putting it down in Arizona or are you putting it up in Maine? The United States average is somewhere around 1,700 kilowatt hours per year you can expect out of a square meter of PV. Okay? They look at all the studies. They looked at two types of solar modules, a 75 watt single crystalline module. They found it takes about 7,000 kilowatt hours to make. And so here's the dotted line that goes along here. And the average amount of solar energy that falls on that solar panel is about 1,700. And you connect the dots, and you end up here at a line, which is a 4-year payback. If you use a different type of module, which is copper indium diselenide, has a lower manufacturing energy, it pays for itself in terms of its energy that it costs to make it at 2 years' time. Okay? 2 to 4 years. Other studies have varied. The other best studies in the industry are right here, these two points right here and here, falling between 3 and 6. Solar modules last a long, long time. How long? Nobody knows. We expect the systems that we put in today to at least last 30 years. We think they'll last 50 years or more. It's probable that a squirrel will eat through a wire or somebody will dig up something and the system will fail in that fashion before the modules themselves give up and stop producing electricity. With minimal maintenance, solar is essentially forever.
Do they degrade over time?
They do, but about 10 to 15% depending on the type of solar module. From their original output, they drop that 10 or 15% over maybe 5 years of time, and then they plateau, essentially constant for the unknowable future. Yeah. Okay, so that's PV. So PV does pay. Yes?
I had some of the comments also about PV. Somebody said something about they use some highly toxic material in their manufacture. I forget what it was, but
yeah. That's a wild. In the single crystalline case, here, I'll throw this up. Silicon is not a toxic material. Other modules, particularly these copper indium diselenide. Copper is not particularly friendly in ionic form. Indium, probably not. And some of the chemicals used in manufacturing are not particularly friendly. But they're relatively small amounts. In practice, we've never installed anything but a silicon crystalline module. They are 90%+ of the world's supply of PV, and I think will continue to be so. The others are interesting. They're always looking for better, cheaper technologies, but they may have offsetting environmental negatives that make them not so cheap if you account for them. Okay, good question. These people were very fastidious when they looked at what's involved. for the single crystal and 75-watt module made by Siemens Solar. 2,875 different materials go into the manufacture of it, and they quantified them all. These are just the big ones. There's silicon right at the top, and then the aluminum right after that. Here's the one that went into the copper indium diselenide module. It's all the aluminum frame, and there's a whole bunch of other stuff. The indium is way down here. Copper's down there. If we were all so careful about thinking about the life cycle of every material, everything we buy and use, and yet somehow the renewable energy industry is put up to doing studies like this, to quantify the impact of their energy, you know, it makes you wonder. For example, yeah, there is no technology without an impact. Anything has an impact. Any particular location is going to have its own best choice or choices, let's say, of energy generating technologies. So it's site dependent, let's say. There are some sites where geothermal ground source heat pumps are inappropriate, where you don't have good energy exchange, heat exchange with the earth because of the underlying soil structure, the geology. You may live in a place where there's no wind at all. You may live in a neighborhood where there's towering oaks, 150 feet tall, that make solar impractical. It's very site dependent. But considered over a large enough area, you're going to find points where any or all of these technologies are applicable. You know, these are decisions that have to be made intelligently. If you have the resource, you have the biomass resource, you can make methane from it. In fact, burning methane, whatever its source, is a good thing. Methane is such a powerful greenhouse gas, it's better to burn it and convert it into carbon dioxide than it is to leave it as methane and go up into the atmosphere. Burn it. Stop it from coming out of our landfills. Let's collect it and burn it, because it has far less of an environmental impact if we do so. I think that's not widely appreciated. Well, for instance, in downtown Ithaca, there is no or very little wind resource. You're not going to put up a wind turbine in downtown Ithaca. If you live 20 miles north of here on a ridge between the lakes, you may want to put up a wind turbine, because that's your best renewable resource. Solar in Ithaca can make sense, and it can also not make sense. Major life cycle environmental impacts of energy sources on electric generation, starting with our friend coal. There are impacts on the air, on our climate, land, water use and quality, on creatures, and of course, radiation. Coal has high impacts all throughout, except perhaps for radiation. Oil, high and moderate impacts in each of these categories. Natural gas, similarly. It's a little better than coal and oil. As we know, it burns more cleanly. There's biomass for you. Low or moderate impact on air pollution. I think that's very interesting, because that's not what most people, that's counterintuitive. It's not what most people would say. Climate change, very low if the growth of the biomaterials is sustainable. Otherwise, it's quite high. Land use, low or near zero, depending on how the biomass conversion is conducted. Water use, yeah, lots of water is used, but it has a very low impact on the water quality. And again, wildlife, radiation. And then we come to wind and solar, essentially near zero, with land use again coming up. wind, they're concerned about displacing other uses for the land where these large wind turbines go up. For small wind turbines, residential farm settings, essentially no impact. Farmers going to have cows walking under these wind turbines, for heaven's sakes. Photovoltaic, very high land use. Well, yes, I mean, if you're covering land that could be used for other purposes, what if you're putting them in the desert? Probably not much impact there.
Or over your parking lot.
Or over a parking lot. It might be a beneficial impact. Yeah. New York State allows net metering for solar, electric, and wind. The governor signed net metering for wind into law on the 12th of September. It officially goes into effect on the 12th of March, 6 months later. They have the 6 month period so the utilities can figure out how they're going to deal with it contractually with net metered customers and what their policies are. But
is that commercial and residential?
Residential net metered wind is allowed up to 25 kilowatts in size for the generator, 125 kilowatts if you're a farm. Okay. There's a never-never land between 125 kilowatts and megawatt land, which are utility scale, which has not yet been addressed. I have plenty to say about that, but I want to get to more questions. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask about the geothermal. Okay. Is that a technology for generating electricity or just for heating?
Good question. Because there's confusion with this term geothermal. I'm going to set it to rest, I hope, right now. Historically, geothermal brought up a picture in people's minds of like hot underground sources, like geysers, and like in Iceland. You know, you drill a few meters below the surface in Iceland and the ground is hot, okay? Just due to the geothermal activity, okay, underneath the landmass. When we talk about geothermal here in New York, we're talking about something very different. The term we like to use now is ground source heating, or ground source heat pumps is the device that exchanges heat between the earth and a building. Okay, about 6 feet down, the earth is a constant temperature, 52 degrees Fahrenheit or so, plus or minus a couple of degrees depending on where you are. That's what we might call geothermal, but we're trying to change the terminology, ground source heating. All right. There's this thermal reservoir, which is the earth, constant temperature. You can harvest that essentially limitless source of energy to assist in the heating of your building with a ground source heat pump. All right.
Okay, so it's a heating, not an electricity generator.
No.
But that would save you from having to generate electricity to do some form of heating or
yeah.
to
Electric
mitigate it.
Resistance heating is the most expensive type of heating there is. There are better ways to do it. Yeah. If you're going to use electricity to make heat, the most efficient way of doing it is with a heat pump, a ground source heat pump.
How efficient is that?
Ground source heat pumps are probably 40 to 60% more efficient than conventional generation. Okay, heating by conventional energy sources, natural gas or oil or coal. Okay, in terms of the absolute amount of energy they use, if you convert it to a common denominator, That's what I mean when I say 40 to 60% more efficient.
Well, how does it work out for consumer costs?
Initial costs are quite high, maybe 2 to 3 times what a conventional boiler might cost you. The energy savings are realized in a best case maybe around 10 years, in a worst case maybe around 20 years. But the average life of a system is 30 years. You'll recover that cost and more if you can take the long view. If you can't deal with that upfront cost, then there's nothing to be done. Yeah.
Well, I guess at the risk of getting hit with a large stick in this crowd, I want to say first that we have to minimize, but I'm sort of resigned to the fact that
our environment will be around long after we are, long after raptors, long after anyone. And I was just hoping maybe you could say something about the human environment. You've gone into people's homes before they have these technologies, and then after. What is the human environment in the home? How is it different? I mean, what is the quality like?
I'm
do you see the change?
Question.
Or
I'm going to defer it.
Okay.
One of these two. How has the human environment changed in a solar electric home?
So I should preface this with saying Art and Rob designed, we have a PV system that generates 2.4 kilowatts on a really bright sunny day when it's cold. And we have solar hot water system. And I just got interviewed by Cornell Cooperative Extension by a bunch of 6th and 7th graders who kind of asked that question, not quite so eloquently. And it makes you so much more aware of your energy use. It changes your whole outlook on life. And when they first put in, what they do is they put in a great monitor, and we have it in our dining room, so you can see how much energy you're using at any given moment, and you can see how much energy is being generated by your photovoltaics. And even before the panels came online, because NYSEG's a total pain in the rump about these things, maybe they've gotten better, you can still watch how much energy you're using. And you become very aware of things like, I can tell you, toasters are unbelievable. Talking about passing a current through resistance to generate heat. Humidifiers, those little humidifiers you use to, those use so much energy, we don't use them anymore. So we won't talk about the electric motor. Anyway, so you become incredibly aware of the energy you use, and you change your life around that. You get rid of things that use a lot of energy. You are better about turning things off, especially me, who John, what is you call me? The lighting princess or something like that. but we of course beforehand changed everything to compact fluorescence and did energy saving things. But I think our life is totally different because of this infatuation with the impact we're making. And for those of you who decided to do this, the other thing we did recently, which was very illuminating, is we had, what's the name of the company? John Harrod's company?
Mm-hmm. Performance Systems Contracting.
Performance Systems Contracting come through and do an analysis of our house. And we found out our house has no insulation in the walls. Mm-hmm. So if you are going to do this type of change in your life, I would strongly recommend having that analysis done on your house and, you know, taking that action. But and I think you become more sensitive to the world around you because you've done that. And I think if everybody had one of those little, even if they didn't have photovoltaics, if they just had a monitor so they could see how much energy they use, I think it would really change the way people live. Now your life runs by the sun more, and you wake up and you're like, oh, wow, it's 20 degrees out and it's sunny, you know, we're going to have a great kilowatt day. You know, it's such a nerdy thing, but it's really fun. So.
Yeah, I'll just provide a little more laid back. kind of an attitude about it, because we've got a 3.4 kilowatt system, and you know, when I first had it, I did go up and look at it a lot, see what the output was at various times of the day, depending on the sunlight and season and whatnot. But really, the only time that I really pay any attention is when I get the utility bill, and I see whether we made more power than we used it that particular billing period or not, and. Because I have a business that uses some resistance heaters. When my business is cranking, I'll consistently use more power than I generate. But when I'm not in business mode, then we generate more power than we use. So, I mean, I really don't pay much attention to it otherwise than that. And it's been just kind of there doing its thing and don't do anything. Just live with it, and it makes no difference in our lives what we do. We haven't, other than going to those high efficiency light bulbs and Energy Star appliances, which again are just things that you screw them in, plug them in, and you don't think about it. You know, it hasn't affected the way I live at all.
He's just not a nerd.
No, you see, you gotta
give
kids
or something. We haven't got the little meter.
I was just going to put in a plug for some of the things you didn't talk about, like passive solar, for example,
right.
Is the primary heating source for our house. And that's extremely renewable, and we live by the sun as well.
Oh, yeah,
and it's cold sometimes in our house, and then I put on a scarf, you know. And I guess, you know, just compact fluorescence and insulation is other things you can do. And also, if you're waiting to be able to afford solar, for example, like we are, then, you know, you can choose where you buy your electricity as well, and that's a good way to be more renewable in your home without having to buy a system with someone, you know. There's trade-offs, but it's not only the option that you're mentioning.
Absolutely. One of those references there that I list is a link to a page of energy companies that you can purchase your electricity from now. That have, you know, a various mix of energy sources in them, ranging from completely conventional, you know, the usual mixture of coal and nuclear, to mostly wind. Take your pick. Yeah, you'll pay a little bit more for the renewables, but it's such an easy thing to do, and it's not that dear to your pocketbook. So if you can't, you know, afford or want to deal with, you know, an active system of your own, or don't want to build a beautifully passive solar house, that's at least one way you can have an immediate impact. NYSEG has 834,000 service customers. Of that, roughly 50,000 have returned that form that we're all supposed to by the end of the year. That tells you something about the effectiveness in their communicating what needs to be done here. I mean,
I had a question about this wind thing, in the sense that there's a certain amount of power that there's a certain number of people in a population, those people are going to use X amount of power. It almost doesn't matter where that power comes from if there's no incentive to make more wind. Say, to what extent is this wind option just a feel-good thing, and it really has no effect on the total, because the coal plants are going to generate X, the wind power is going to generate X no matter what. And so in what way does my using wind change the equation? Does it encourage the production of more wind?
It does, in fact.
Does it?
Yes. There's only a certain amount, as you say, of wind generating capacity. Once that's all subscribed, and they have to account for it, you know, they know that the average customer uses this number of kilowatt hours, you know, per month or per year annually, and so that takes up some fraction of all the wind that the utility has purchased to distribute to their customers. Once all of that's subscribed, they can't sell anymore. That provides incentive for the construction of more wind.
And do you have a sense of where we are in the...
I don't. I don't know what the status there is. I suspect we're still very undersubscribed. Why is that? Because it costs a penny or two more per kilowatt hour to buy wind than it does conventional.
2.5 pennies.
Which some of us think is a scam on NYSEG's part, and not having to do with the cost of wind power.
Again, I'm not going to comment because it's politically difficult for me to do so. Yeah.
Under subscription. Yeah.
At the same time.
He was asking if you're on the net meter.
Buying your power,
you
don't have to buy theirs. All you have to do is...
Yes, that's right. You can choose your own provider. NYSEG is just in the transmission and distribution business. They are purchasing the power that they distribute from a variety of different sources, primarily coal and nuclear. But if there were intense public pressure, everybody wants wind. Give me wind, give me wind. The wind capacity would quickly be oversubscribed, and the utilities then would have to put pressure on the providers of wind or the developers of wind projects. Make more. Our customers want this. They're willing to pay for it. Yeah.
What's the situation at this point with government subsidies for residential users who want to put up solar panels or wind turbines or stuff? What is there to help people afford that?
NYSERDA has two programs. $4 per watt for residential solar. So that means for a 1,000 watt system, you get $4,000 back, okay, uh-huh. And so on up.
It's a rebate.
It's a rebate. It's a direct rebate. A company like ours gives it to the potential client right up front.
Can I just to gain some understanding, you say it's a $4,000 rebate on say this 1,000
per,
watt
per
system?
Per kilowatt, yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. And this 1,000, without the rebate, what would be an approximate cost of such
about
a thing?
$10,000.
So it's like a 40%,
it's like a 40%
percent rebate. Okay.
Yep. For wind, it's half of the total installed cost. It's not based on watts or anything like that. That's too nebulous for wind because
right.
the wind mm-hmm. is a fickle thing. It's based on total installed cost. For residential wind installations, half of the total installed cost. If you're a farm, 60%. If you're a school that incorporates some aspect of wind education in your curriculum, 70%.
How do they define farm?
$10,000 of farm-related income on Schedule F of your income tax.
Even though the chart says potentially high on hydroelectric, I still can't believe that this area can't do something with hydropower.
You're right. I can't either. There are lots of potentially very good small hydro sites all over. Like wind, when we get there and we start developing these things, there's going to be permitting issues. How do we harvest that energy while having the least impact on the stream itself? Okay? Now historically, as many people here know, there were small hydro plants all over, including at Cornell. They're largely, you know, not functional anymore.
Generates like 2%
meaningful, nonetheless, yeah.
Can you say something about what the cost of renewable power, especially I guess residential scale, what the cost of that installed cost of it is historically and projected into the future? You know, where has it gone in the past 10 years and what's expected? I assume it's getting less expensive.
Yeah, until just recently it was becoming less expensive. The price definitely for solar now, electric, has been coming down. In the last few months there's been a little bit of an upward trend again. The reason is that the world demand for solar modules has increased beyond the manufacturing base. Where is all the solar going? It's going to Germany. It's going to Japan. It's going to Spain.
Yeah, but I'm asking over years and
over
decades
over
rather
years,
than
it's definitely coming down. And you know, we hope, just as we saw with computer technology, you know, we hope that the manufacturing base becomes sufficiently large and the demand becomes sufficiently high that the costs continue to go down. In the meantime, we have these incentive programs that state agencies like NYSERDA provide, which brings down the cost dramatically. Okay, we look forward to the day when those incentive programs are gone. They are a pain to deal with, the amount of paperwork that's involved. It's remarkable.
NYSERDA also offers reduced interest rates on loans for your PV system. So you get the rebate, and then you can get, is it shave off about 4 percentage points?
Exactly.
Off of a loan?
Okay, here.
Is there a time frame on the NYSERDA stuff, or is there a
fund current,
that...
The current PV program expires in December of 2006, excuse me, it was extended. The current wind program expires at the end of 2005, December 2005. In all likelihood, they will be extended. And in fact, I think they will be enhanced because, as some people here will know, the governor recently signed legislation concerning the renewable portfolio standard for New York, where the state will be required to buy 25% of its electricity from renewables by the year 2013. 25% sounds like an enormous number. Hydro, big hydro, large hydro is included in that number. It amounts to some 18% of that 25%. But still, 7%, that difference. We've got to go from roughly 1%, a little less than that, from where we are now in 2005 to 7% in 8 years, it's going to require an enormous investment in of effort just to meet 7% from wind and solar.
But this is the state's consumption.
That's the state's consumption.
Not the people.
Not
state.
Residential. Right. But we're going to see some big public projects.
So I just wanted to follow up on Ian's question, and this is a statement and a question that maybe you could return to something you said at the very beginning of your talk about the quality of life, and you were asking about humans, and there's a very good article by Norman Meyer called called Future Evolution. And what will life be like if we pull out, especially like our large mammals and such, and what animals will we have here for evolution to act on in the future, which is something nobody really thinks about. Mm-hmm. And then I think that's absolutely tied in with the quality of human life, which of course is exemplified by the quote from Chief Seattle, which is actually in the Singapore Zoo, if you ever go there, that what happens to animals happens to humans. And as the animals go, so will the humans. And so you talked about peak oil, and could you say a bit more about peak oil and what
when you think is going to happen?
It sort of has relevance to this last diagram here. Peak oil happened in the United States in the 1970s. Production has been flat and now declining since that time. Peak oil globally is now, right now. Maybe it's past, maybe it's a year ahead, two? Nobody knows quite for sure, but we're there. And we're on the decline. So we're never going to be able to produce more oil than we're producing right now or historically produced already. The flip side of that is the world demand for oil is increasing rapidly. This curve starts in 1990. We're here in 2005. This is a nice S-curve, or a sigmoidal curve if you're a scientist. It sort of gives a quasi-scientific justification for why renewables are off to such a slow start. Well, we're on this part of this S-curve. Well, we get up here, 2020, things are moving very, very rapidly, and then it slows down until renewables are 100% of the energy generation in the world by the year 2050. There's no escaping this. They must be 100% by 2050, because there will be no more fossil fuel resources by then. It will all be used up. 2050, that's 45 years old, from 45 years from now. So a child born today will be my age, standing here in 2050. They won't even be talking about conventional use, except historically. It'll all be gone. This has bearing on all of our children, our grandchildren, and us in our old age. You know, it's like any resource that's extracted from the earth. It follows a bell-shaped curve. You keep looking and extracting more and more and more, and you see eventually this curve becomes apparent with time. And we've now been through the first half of that curve. It's been level for some time. All that can happen is the mirror image to that bell-shaped curve. It's a statistical thing. We're not going to find anymore. It's happening. It will be a bell-shaped curve. That curve ends in 2050, period. You know, we don't want to waste it in combustion right now. We don't want to be burning this stuff. We want to use it. It's a good resource. Yeah. It really is. We want to use it for more value-added kinds of materials. Asphalt is one. Plastics.
In all of this, hydrogen is really just a way to move energy around.
Yeah, I haven't said one word about hydrogen, nor have any of these studies. There's two ways to make hydrogen. The one that the current powers that be are looking at is extracting it from petroleum and natural gas. They're hydrocarbons, after all. There is some promise in improving technology to get better and better storage forms of hydrogen. And there's no doubt that vehicles will, in fact, one day run on hydrogen. Heavy equipment will run on hydrogen with no emissions whatsoever, water dripping out the other end of the vehicle. Where does that fuel come from? How do you make it? You can make it from petroleum, or natural gas. You can also make it from water by splitting water apart with electricity. Where does the electricity come from? Renewably. That's the only option. So yes, hydrogen is a good fuel, but we need to make it renewably.
Beyond, right.
BP Solar and Shell Solar are now two of the largest solar module manufacturers in the world. These corporations aren't dumb. They see the writing on the wall. They know their resource is history.
Hard to get a question on a totally different tack. On the photovoltaic panels have a limited lifetime, 20, 30 years, 40 years, something like that.
Sure.
When their lifespan is over, what happens to them? Or they, can you recycle them? Or are they toxic?
The prevalent type of module, silicon only, single crystalline or amorphous silicon, yes, they should be recycled because of the aluminum content of their frames.
Mm-hmm.
They have very small amounts of other metals in them. Silver, for example, to make the soldered connections between the cells. All of that should be reclaimed. That's part of the decommissioning process that I was showing charts about earlier. And there will be some energy cost associated with that. But 50 years is a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there PV modules that have run their lifespan and that aren't?
We occasionally see one. The original solar cells were produced in, I believe it was 1953 at Bell Laboratories. Three of them were made. Of those three, they were about an inch square. Of those three, two of them are still in perfect operating condition. Those were the first ones ever made. The third one failed because water got in between the glass layer that they used to protect the top surface and the silicon substrate underneath it. That is also the main cause for compromise of any module today. Water getting in between the silicon layers of the cells and the glass cover. Now, there's materials called encapsulants, sort of flowy, gooey stuff that goes between the glass layer and the silicon cells. It essentially impervious to water. The only way you can damage these things is by a physical impact to them, which is quite rare. They have warranties now for 20 to 25 years across the spectrum of manufacturers. We routinely tell people we think these will last for 50 years or more. We really don't know. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Art Weaver, founder and president of Renovus Energy, which installs renewable energy systems in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all